Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 326 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be discussing a very important topic. It's just a topic that, unfortunately, many resources don't cover well. But it's something that shows up very frequently on MBME exams. And when it shows up, good numbers of people get these things wrong. So I'm going to be calling this topic Hemodynamic Physiology in MBME Pediatric Cardiology Problems. Again, I know it's kind of weird, right? So I'll call it again, Hemodynamic Physiology in MBME Pediatric Cardiology Problems. And I'll just leave it at that. You'll get the drift as we go along. And as a quick announcement, if you're taking the USMLE Step 2 CT or Step 3 exams soon, I do have a review course coming up next week. First, it starts with the MBME Test Taking Strategies course on Wednesday from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then I have the review course that's going to be taking place on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday next week, from the 15th to the 17th. And in that course, we're going to be covering PEDS, surgery, IM, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, biostats, ethics, communications, healthcare systems, professionalism. Just again, a very good broad overview of the material that's routinely tested on the USMLE exams. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. So the thing is, because this topic is kind of nebulous and is convoluted, I'm going to try to make it as high yield as possible. So how am I going to do that? The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to basically ask myself a bunch of questions, and then I'm going to answer them. They're just basically like thought questions. Again, I'll try to explain or simplify the physiology as much as possible, but I promise you, this stuff I'm explaining here is not something you can just mess around with. It's something you do need to understand. It's something that pops up a lot on MBME exams, pops up a lot on practice exams. So definitely something I'd know if I were you. So the first question I'm going to ask myself is, why do VSDs get more symptomatic days to weeks after birth? So why do they get more symptomatic, or why do they get louder days to weeks after birth? Well, the reason here is, if you think about it, when a child is in utero, the child is basically not using their lungs. Their lungs are basically a bag of fluid. All the oxygen supply for the fetus essentially comes from mom through the placenta. So because the lungs are not getting any oxygen, being in utero is a state of relative hypoxia. That relatively hypoxic state in utero is going to cause pulmonary vasoconstriction. So if your pulmonary vessels are constricted, then that's going to make the right-sided heart pressures really high. That's why physiologically in utero, you have a right to left shunt. You have multiple rights to left shunts, just because, again, the pressures on the right side of the heart are much greater than the pressures on the left side of the heart. So that's a key important point to know. So in utero, the right-sided heart pressures are really high. Well, think about it. The moment a child is born, what is the first thing that happens? First thing that happens is that that child begins to cry. One of the reasons I believe that those kids cry is because by crying, they are opening up their mouths and they are bringing oxygen in. When you bring in oxygen, that removal of that in utero hypoxia is going to cause pulmonary vasodilation. When you get pulmonary vasodilation, that's going to lower the right-sided heart pressures. And the thing is, as the child becomes more and more removed from the time of birth, those pulmonary vascular pressures go down even more. Again, as the child uses more of his lungs, because, you know, the lungs will still be wet even after the child is born. But as the child uses those lungs more, that lack of hypoxia will then cause a pulmonary vasodilation. And when you get that pulmonary vasodilation, that's going to reduce the right-sided heart pressures. So think about it. If you have a VSD, what's going to happen? Well, a VSD, the left ventricle, right, since it has higher pressures than the right ventricle, blood is going to be flowing from the left ventricle to the right ventricle, right? So because, let's say like a normal left ventricle, the pressures there is like 125, and then a normal right ventricle, the pressures there are like 25. Right. So because there is the pressures are high on the left ventricle, you know, things will always flow from the region of high pressure spontaneously to the region of low pressure. So blood is going to flow from the high pressure region, left ventricle, to the low pressure region, right ventricle, right? So if those right ventricular pressures are decreasing even more, so let's say, oh, it's going from 25 at birth to 20 to 15 to 10, right? Then that gradient is getting even bigger, that gradient of flow, because the pressure difference is getting bigger between the left ventricle and the right ventricle. So that's why in general, VSDs, they get louder as you go away from the child being born. Because again, that increased gradient of flow, there's with more flow, right? There's just going to be more sound you're getting, right? And again, that's why those kids can also get more symptomatic. Because again, as the pressure gradient gets bigger, then there's more flow across the VSD, right? That's going to put more, the left ventricle will just have to work harder, right? So classically, those kids, they'll be sweating with feeds. Sweating with feeds is a pretty classic presentation of some kind of cardiac defect on NBM exams. But many times when these kids that have VSDs that are becoming symptomatic have symptoms, most times those kids will be acyanotic. So you look at their O2 sats on NBM exams and you'll still be in the 90s, right? Because the thing is, if you have a VSD, it's an acyanotic defect, well, at least until the person develops Eisenmenger's, which we'll talk about later in this podcast. Okay, so again, I've answered my first question, right? So again, VSDs, they get more symptomatic days to weeks after birth because the right ventricular pressures progressively decrease as you go away from being born, right? And there'll be more flow through those VSDs because of the increased pressure gradient, right? And again, they're going to get louder because of more flow. Now, my second question here is, why is there a diastolic rumble at the apex in a VSD? Because many people know that, oh, a VSD shows up as a holosystolic murmur at the left lower sternal border, right? And then you learn that, oh, there's also an apical diastolic rumble at the apex. Well, if you think about this, when a person has a VSD, again, blood is going to flow from the left ventricle to the right ventricle. As it flows from the left ventricle to the right ventricle, that means the right ventricle is getting its preload from two sources. It's getting its preload first from the right atrium, but it's also getting its preload from the left ventricle. So because it's getting more preload by the Frank-Starling mechanism, the cardiac output of the right ventricle will be higher than normal. It's just literally getting blood. Before, it will get blood from only one source, right atrium. But now it's getting from right atrium, left ventricle, right? So because it's getting from both, the preload is high. So the amount of blood in the right ventricle is high. So according to the Frank-Starling principle, if you put more blood in the right in a chamber of the heart, it will eject more blood. So because you're putting more blood in the right ventricle, more blood is going to be ejected into the pulmonary arteries, and that more blood is going to go to the pulmonary capillaries, and that more blood is going to go to the pulmonary veins, and that more blood is going to go to the left atrium, and that more blood is going to flow through the mitral valve into the left ventricle. So because you have an increased amount of blood flow through the mitral valve, that's going to show up as a flow murmur on auscultation. That's why those people have a mid-diastolic rumble, because the left ventricle is filling with that increased blood from the left atrium across the mitral valve. That's why you hear that mid-diastolic rumble at the apex, right? So again, what are some other ways they can test this information I just described? When a person has a VSD, their right ventricular end-diastolic volume is going to go up, because again, you're just getting preload from two sources, from the right atrium and from the left ventricle. And also, every chamber that is distal to that, distal to the right ventricle, is also going to get like increased preload, right? So like, for example, when a person has a VSD, again, because of that increased blood flow from right ventricle to pulmonary arteries, to pulmonary capillaries, to pulmonary veins, right? The left atrium is going to be getting more preload. The left atrium is going to, its volume is going to get bigger, right? So the left atrial end diastolic volume, left atrial preload is going to be bigger, right? In fact, the left atrial pressures are going to be bigger. So that's something that's particularly high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. Okay, now my third question here is, when you fix a VSD, what happens to cardiac hemodynamics, right? So this is something I'm going to talk about in the context of just with a recourse to the second question I just answered. So think about it, right? If you fix a VSD, so let's look at what happens after you fix a VSD. When you fix a VSD, you're literally closing off those pressures that exist between the left ventricle and the right ventricle. So the thing is, when you turn off that connection, well, what's going to happen? Well, the thing that's going to happen is your left ventricle, since it's no longer like leaking blood, your left ventricular pressures will go up. That's very important to know, because again, the left ventricle before was leaking blood to the aorta, but also, you know, which is what should happen normally. But at the same time, it was also leaking blood to your right ventricle. So if it's not leaking that blood, the pressures in it, the left ventricular in the diastolic volume will go up, right? So the LVEDP will go up, right? So the left ventricular pressures will go up. Now, your right ventricle, before the VSD was fixed, it was getting preload from the right atrium and from the left ventricle. But now, it's not anymore. It's only getting preload from the place it's supposed to get preload from, the right atrium. The right atrium. So since it's getting only from the right atrium, the thing that's going to happen is that the right ventricular pressures will actually go down. The right ventricular pressures will actually go down. So again, think about what I just discussed in question number two. If the right ventricular pressures are going down, then that means those things that are distal, right, that are getting flow from the right ventricle, direct flow from the right ventricle, the pressures in them will go down as well, right? So like your pulmonary arterial pressures will go down, your pulmonary capillary pressures will go down, your pulmonary venous pressures will go down, and your left atrial pressures will go down as well. That's very important to know. Because again, what is the source of preload for the left atrium? It's the right ventricle. So if the right ventricular pressures are going down, then the left atrial pressures will go down as well. But again, don't conflate the fact that the left atrial pressure is going down mean that the left ventricular pressures will go down. No. The left ventricle is no longer leaking blood into two compartments. It's now just leaking blood into the aorta. That's all it's doing, right? So the left ventricular pressures will go up because that VSD has been fixed. So again, in summary, when a VSD is fixed, the left ventricular pressures go up, the right ventricular pressures go down, and the left atrial pressures go down as well. I've explained the pathophysiology behind that. Now, question number four, how does transposition of the great vessels present on an MBM exam? How does transposition of the great vessels present on an MBM exam? And what do you do about it, right? So let's talk about this, right? So the thing is, when a person has transposition of the great vessels, remember, the normal situation that's supposed to happen is that your left ventricle is supposed to drain into your aorta, and then your right ventricle is supposed to drain into your pulmonary artery. That's what's supposed to happen. But if a person has transposition of the great vessels, usually that happens because there's like some mess up with your aorticopulmonary septum, then your right ventricle is going to be draining into your aorta, and your left ventricle is going to be draining into your pulmonary artery. As you can see, that's not a good thing. Well, let me explain why. Think about it. If your right ventricle is draining into your aorta, that means deoxygenated blood, you know, came into your right atrium, went to the right ventricle, and then drained into the aorta. And the aorta is the blood supply for the rest of the body. So that blood you're sending to the rest of the body is deoxygenated blood. And then that blood is going to come right back to the right atrium, go through the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle, go into the aorta again. So notice you're literally recirculating deoxygenated blood. On the flip side, for the left side of the heart, blood is going left atrium, left ventricle, but the left ventricle is draining into the pulmonary artery. So that blood flowing from the left ventricle into the pulmonary artery, right, will go to the pulmonary capillaries, go into the pulmonary veins, and then come right back to the left atrium. So guess what? On the left side of the heart, you're literally recirculating oxygenated blood. Obviously, that's not going to be consistent with life. But the thing is, many times, those kids are able to survive in utero because there are many connections between the right-sided circulation and the left-sided circulation, right? So what are those connections? Well, the key one that you probably want to keep in mind for your test is the ductus arteriosus, right? Is the ductus arteriosus. That ductus arteriosus is a connection between the pulmonary artery and the person's aorta. And because in utero, you know, the pulmonary artery has higher pressures for reasons I've described in the first question, then blood is going to flow from pulmonary artery to the person's aorta, right? So oxygenated blood literally in those pulmonary arteries, right, that are coming from the left ventricle in a person that has transposition of the great vessels will flow from the pulmonary artery into the aorta. And then that oxygenated blood can go from the aorta to the rest of the body. So the child can oxygenate in utero, no problem, right? And also, you know, maybe the first few hours of birth, because it's not like the moment a child is born, within seconds, the doctor's closes. No, that is not what happens, right? So many times, those kids, when they are born, for the first few hours, in fact, sometimes up to the first few days of birth, those kids are doing perfectly fine because that ductus is still open, right? So blood is still flowing, like there's still mixing of blood across that open ductus arteriosus between the pulmonary artery and the aorta, right? But the thing is, if the ductus then starts doing what it's supposed to do, as it starts closing, then that communication between the right-sided circulation and the left-sided circulation will be gone. And once it's gone, then that child is probably going to die pretty soon, right? Many times when you give those kids oxygen, they will not respond appropriately to it. Let's say you give the child oxygen and you notice that, wow, this child's PaO2 went from, like, I don't know, like 60 to 61, or the SaO2 went from like 50% to 51%. That is not a big, basically that child is not responding, right? And those kids are gonna die, right? So that's how transposition of the great vessels as a concept presents on NBM exams, right? And they will try to trick you many times into doing like an endotracheal intubation or all those things, but those are not the right things to do for those people. The right things you want to do for those people on NBM exams, your first step always on an NBM exam is to give those kids a prostaglandin E1 analog. I'll say that again, a prostaglandin E1 analog, like alprostadil. Because by giving alprostadil is a potent vasodilator, it's a prostaglandin analog. So we'll keep that ductus open so that you can actually supply, you can still have more mixing of blood between the right-sided circulation and the left-sided circulation until you can take the child for cardiac surgery. The thing is, intubation does not really help those kids, because actually, by giving more oxygen, if I'm not mistaken, you'd potentially speed up the closure of the ductus arteriosus, and that can worsen the child's problem, right? So you need to give that alprostadil first before you do pretty much any other thing. That's very high yield to understand. Again, I think giving more oxygen actually speeds up closure of the ductus. I may not be 100% on that, but that physiologically makes sense to me, and I'll probably talk about that in some future podcast. So, is there some other case scenario you may see on an NBM exam where giving alprostadil is a good thing, especially with Pate's cardio? Actually, I would say another good situation to do this is with a child that has very severe coarctation of the aorta. The thing is, when a child has severe coarctation of the aorta, right, the aorta basically is not able to send blood to the rest of the body. Right, I'll say that again. The aorta is not able to send blood to the rest of the body. So the remaining body regions get super hypoxic, right? And they are not getting any nutrients, right? So giving alprostadil as a first step is actually really helpful there. Because by giving alprostadil, again, a prostaglandin E1 analog, you're going to open up the person's ductus arteriosus. That's going to cause more communication between the pulmonary artery and the aorta, right? So blood can pretty much bypass that obstruction in the aorta. Because remember, normally, you know, blood will flow through the aorta to the rest of the body, right? But if the ductus is open, right? If the ductus is open, right? Then blood is going to flow from the pulmonary artery through the ductus arteriosus into the aorta and bypass the coarctation. That's something that can help until you can take the child to surgery and go ahead and fix the problem. So basically, the systemic blood flow is literally coming from the pulmonary artery. But that pulmonary artery is the thing that, the shunt that gets it to the aorta is that ductus arteriosus. So blood will flow from pulmonary artery to ductus arteriosus to the aorta. So again, that's very important, very high yield to know and understand. And then the next thing I want to talk about here, my next question here is, what is the pathophysiology behind? So this is question number 5. What is the pathophysiology behind Eisenmenger syndrome? Well, the pathophysiology behind Eisenmenger syndrome is when you have a large VSD and you don't fix it, right? Or you have a large ASD and you don't fix it. The thing is, again, if you keep getting all this excess blood flow to the right ventricle, over time, that excess blood flow to the right ventricle is going to flow through, again, pulmonary arteries, pulmonary capillaries, pulmonary veins. Those, the thing is, the right side of the heart is not built to handle those kinds of pressures. So over time, the person will get pulmonary arterial hypertension. And when they get pulmonary arterial hypertension, that your right ventricular pressures will progressively increase. If it progressively increases, at some point it can increase to the point where it exceeds the left ventricular pressures. If it exceeds the left ventricular pressures, then what was previously, like, let's say a VSD where it was like a left to right acyanotic shunt will then become a right to left cyanotic shunt. And when that happens, then the child will become hypoxic. Many times those people will have decreased pulmonary vascular markings because now there is reduced blood flow through the pulmonary arteries. Remember, pulmonary vascular markings are a surrogate for blood flow through the pulmonary arteries, right? They are surrogate for blood flow. So if you have increased pulmonary vascular markings, it means there's a lot of blood flow through pulmonary arteries. If you have decreased pulmonary vascular markings, that means there's very much reduced blood flow through pulmonary arteries. Okay, now question number 6 for me is, what causes pulmonary hypertension in utero? Again, I've pretty much talked about this. This is almost like a physiologic pulmonary hypertension. But remember, in utero, the thing that happens is that you're not using your lungs. Your lungs are literally filled with fluid. So the body senses that as some kind of relative hypoxia. And whenever there is hypoxia, that's going to cause pulmonary vasoconstriction. And if you constrict those vessels, right, that's going to raise the pressures in them. That's going to raise the right-sided heart pressures. Now, question 7, then says, what are some consequences of this pulmonary hypertension not receding at birth, right? Because again, as I explained from question one, when a child is born and takes in that first gust, you know, gust of air, right, that's going to cause pulmonary vasodilation. But if for some reason that pulmonary vasodilation doesn't happen, then the right-sided heart pressures in that child will remain persistently elevated. And if it remains persistently elevated, then many of those shunts that existed in utero will stay, right? Those things that are supposed to close will not close. And if they don't close, you'll keep having blood flowing from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart, right? Because again, this is a very critical concept to understand, is that decrease in pulmonary vascular pressures that comes with that newborn taking in oxygen, that ultimately will lower the right-sided heart pressures. And if that happens, then those shunts begin to close. But if the child, you know, keeps having that pulmonary hypertension, then those right-sided heart pressures will remain elevated. So blood will just keep flowing from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart. And obviously, in those circumstances, that will be some kind of cyanotic shunt. Okay, now, question 8 says, how can cardiac catheterization show that you are dealing with a VSD? How can cardiac catheterization show that you're dealing with a VSD? This is, again, a time-honored thing that our friends at the MBME love to test on exams, right? So it was one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind there. But the key thing I want you to keep at the back of your mind here is when you're doing a cardiac catheterization, right? You know, you can literally measure like oxygen saturations in the blood in the heart, right? So remember, normally, blood that is coming to the right atrium is supposed to be deoxygenated blood. As that blood goes from right atrium to right ventricle, it's supposed to remain deoxygenated, right? So the O2 sats, because I mean, it has not gone to the lungs yet, right? So the O2 sats of blood in the right ventricle that came from the right atrium should either be about the same as the O2 sats as the right atrial blood, or you should have a slightly decreased O2 sat, because obviously the myocardial cells, the endocardial cells, they are, you know, extracting some level of oxygen from that blood. So it's always abnormal when the O2 sats or the PaO2, the partial pressure of oxygen in blood, rises as you go from right atrium to right ventricle. If that happens, then that means some blood is getting into the right side of the heart from an oxygenated blood source, right? Many times that will be like through a VSD, right? So if you notice that, wow, a person's right atrial O2 sats is like, I don't know, like 80%. And then you notice that when it gets to the right ventricle, it becomes 95%. That is completely abnormal. That tells you that that person likely has some kind of VSD that's bringing some oxygenated blood from the left ventricle to the right ventricle. And as he brings that blood, in the right ventricular O2 sats will go up, right? So that's, again, one of these unique situations that they love to throw on exams. And then question 9 here is, what causes left and right axis deviations on an EKG? Well, the big thing I just want you to keep in mind, again, there are many causes of these deviations, but the one that's particularly relevant to know for your exams is hypertrophy of those ventricles, right? So whenever a person has right ventricular hypertrophy, they're going to have right axis deviation on an MBME exam. If a person has left ventricular hypertrophy, they're going to have left axis deviation on an MBME exam. Again, the reasoning behind that is if you have hypertrophy of those cells, right, then you have more electrical activity around those cells. So we kind of mess up like the axis of depolarization of the ventricles, right? So that's why, again, you have those deviations on an EKG. Okay, now question number 10 is, how does the knee chest position help individuals with tetralogy of Fallot to oxygenate better? How does the knee chest position help individuals with a tetralogy of Fallot to oxygenate better? Well, the thing is, if you think about it, when you go in the knee chest position, you actually are because in tetralogy of Fallot, the reason that those kids get cyanotic, right, is because their right-sided heart pressures are greater than their left-sided heart pressures, right? Because remember, in tetralogy of Fallot, you're going to have pulmonic stenosis. So because the pressures on the right side of the heart are greater than pressures on the left side of the heart, that VSD that exists as one of the findings in tetralogy of Fallot will be associated with blood flowing from the right ventricle to the left ventricle, right? Obviously, if you have a right to left shunt, that is going to be a cyanotic shunt, right? So a cyanotic shunt. So if it's a cyanotic shunt, that's obviously going to be bad, right? That's going to be bad. So if that's bad, right, that those kids will then have hypoxia, right? So The thing is, if we could somehow make that right to left shunt a left to right shunt, then those kids will oxygenate well. Enter knee chest position, right? So how does that knee chest position help? Well, it helps in a few ways. The first thing you're doing is that, in fact, probably the most important thing, so this is very high yield to know, the most important thing you're doing is that you're literally, remember your femoral arteries are around your thigh, right? So the thing is, if you do the knee chest position, you're literally going to be squishing on the person's femoral arteries. The femoral arteries are a relatively substantial artery in the human body. By squishing on those arteries, when you literally squish on an artery, what's going to happen? Your systemic vascular resistance is going to go up. If your systemic, not pulmonary, systemic vascular resistance goes up, what's going to happen to your left-sided heart pressures? It's going to get higher, right? Because it gets harder and harder for blood to leave the left ventricle. So the thing that will happen is when you squish on those femorals, that those increased pressures are going to be transmitted upwards to the aorta. So that's going to make the afterload that the left ventricle is experiencing higher. So that's going to make the left ventricular pressures go up. If you raise the left ventricular pressures enough, it can transiently get bigger than the pressures in the right ventricle. And if the left ventricular pressures exceed the pressures in the right ventricle, then blood is going to be flowing down that pressure gradient from the left ventricle to the right ventricle. So what was previously a right to left cyanotic shunt, you are now reversing it by causing a left to right acyanotic shunt, right? And obviously that's going to improve oxygenation because you're essentially sending oxygenated, you're essentially reversing that shunt and helping the person oxygenate better. So that's why the knee chest position helps people with tetralogy of Fallot to oxygenate better. Remember, tetralogy of Fallot is made up of pulmonic stenosis, right ventricular hypertrophy, VSD, and an overriding aorta. And again, I've kind of talked about the pathophys behind that in many different podcasts. Okay, now question 11 says, how does the size of a VSD impact how loud it is? This one is a pretty easy one, right? Basically, if you have a smaller VSD, it's going to be louder because there's just more turbulence of flow. An easy way to understand this is if, for example, you have a hose, if you turn on the hose and water flows out of it, that's situation A. But then let's assume you put like your thumb over like a good cross-sectional area of the edge of the hose, then less water is going to come out. But that water is coming out on the turbulent flow. Is going to start producing a sound, right? So the smaller a VSD is, the louder it becomes, right? So that's very high yield to know for exams. Now, question 12, again, I promise we're getting to the end of this here, is I want to talk about the oxygen delivery equation. So what's the oxygen delivery equation? Basically, the oxygen delivery equation is that your oxygen delivery to the body is going to be the product. So it's going to be equal to your cardiac output multiplied by your blood oxygen content. I'll say that again. The oxygen delivery equation talks about how your cardiac output is basically the product of your cardiac output and your blood oxygen content, right? So why is it important to understand this situation? Well, the key thing I want you to understand here is that if you want to maintain oxygen delivery to the body, whenever the oxygen content of the person's blood goes down, then the cardiac output has to go up as a compensatory measure. Because basically, it's almost like your cells are like, oh, before, you know, blood only had to come around here like 50 times in a minute. But because oxygen has been depleted in the person's blood, then to get the same amount of oxygen supply, you may have to make more runs. So you may have to like show up like 100 times a minute, for example, right? So that's something that may help you understand the pathophysiology behind high output heart failure in a person that has severe anemia, for example, right? In fact, that's my next question here. Like, what happens to cardiac output in an individual with severe anemia? Well, if a person has severe anemia, the oxygen content of their blood is going to go down. Remember, that oxygen content equation is 1.36 multiplied by your hemoglobin, right? Multiplied by your SaO2, right? So the saturation of oxygen, your hemoglobin, plus 0.0031 multiplied by your p little AO2. Right? But basically, the key thing I want to emphasize here is when a person has a severe anemia, that hemoglobin part of the equation, which is actually a major part of the equation, goes down. If that goes down, then the oxygen content of your blood is going to go down. If the oxygen content of your blood goes down, then your cardiac output has to go up, right? Because again, remember, if you want to maintain a constant remember I said oxygen delivery is equal to your cardiac output times your oxygen content of blood, right? So if your oxygen content of blood has gone down because the hemoglobin has gone down, then your cardiac output has to go up if you want to maintain oxygen delivery to the rest of the body. Again, which is very important, high yield principles to understand there. And then the question 14 I want to discuss here is, what's the difference between volume and pressure overload? Well, the thing is, volume overload is something you get many times when you have a regurgitant lesion. Pressure overload is something you get many times when you have a stenotic lesion. I think like a very good example to explain this is aortic stenosis versus aortic regurg, right? So the thing is, when a person has aortic stenosis, it's just harder for blood to leave the left ventricle, right? So because it's harder for blood to leave the left ventricle is like, I need to get bigger and beefier so I can force this blood out. Well, the way the left ventricle is going to get bigger and beefier is it wants to essentially become more muscular. The way it becomes more muscular is by adding sarcomeres in parallel. Right? Because when you add sarcomeres in parallel, it's almost like you're stacking them on top of each other, right? Those sarcomeres are getting more muscular. They can push out that blood, right? That's an example of concentric hypertrophy. That's an example of concentric hypertrophy, right? And many times that's going to be associated with an S4 heart sound, right? So many times those people will end up getting into like some kind of diastolic dysfunction because yes, the left ventricle is getting bigger and beefier, it's getting more muscular, it can pump out more blood. But the problem is, all that muscle that is in the way is going to reduce the cavity size of the left ventricle. So that's going to make it harder for it to fill with blood because there's literally just not enough space since so much muscle has taken our control. Now, if a person has aortic regurg, right? Remember, if a person has aortic regurg, then blood is literally flowing from the aorta back into the left ventricle. The left ventricle, the problem it's facing is not that, oh, I need to get this blood out of the left ventricle. No, the problem it's facing is that, gee, I seem to have all this extra volume that I have to deal with. Because normally, after the left ventricle ejects, you know, a normal ejection fraction is like 60%. You know, it just only has to deal with that, 40% of the blood that was originally in it at the end of diastole. But if a person has aortic regurg, the left ventricle may have to go from dealing with 40% of the, you know, of the original blood that was there at the end of diastole to now having to deal with like 70%, 80%. So your left ventricle is like, you know what? I need to become better at storing this blood. So what does he do? It's going to get bigger. It's going to say, you know what? Because I don't have a pumping problem, so I don't seem to need this muscle so much. Let me just make my cavity size bigger. So how do you make the cavity size bigger? You do that by adding sarcomeres in series. You do that by adding sarcomeres in series. So you add them from end to end, right? I mean, think about it. It's just kind of like our blood vessels. I think I heard, like, I was watching a documentary recently. If you take our blood vessels and line them end to end, it can circle, for a single human being, it can circle the entire globe, like basically the entire world, I think like what, like four times or something ridiculous, right? Or maybe I'm, but it's a really large number, let's just put it that way, right? So essentially, your body is like, your left ventricle is like, well, making a business decision, I don't have a pumping problem, I have a storage problem. So the way you fix your storage problem is by just lining your sarcomeres end to end. That's what's called eccentric hypertrophy. As you do that eccentric hypertrophy, that's going to make your left ventricle cavity size bigger. That's great. You're going to be able to handle those increased volumes. The only problem you're going to then have to face, unfortunately, the problem you're going to have to face is that because those sarcomeres are so far apart, it's going to be so hard for the left ventricle to contract well. They are so far apart, right? They are so far apart. It's like, let's say you're trying to squish someone. You get a very good squish when your arms are as close together as possible because it means you're like literally like squishing those people down really well. But if your arms are super, super far apart, you can't provide much squishing to that person. So the left ventricle is not going to be able to squish your blood very well. So those people will have systolic dysfunction. They'll have an S3 heart sound. That's many times ultimately the pathogenesis behind a heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Okay, and then the final question that I'm going to talk about is, why are kids polycythemic at birth? Again, this is something we should understand just based on what I've discussed already. These are just pretty much all related ideas. But the thing is, at birth, again, while in utero, the kids were not using their lungs. So again, that's interpreted as a state of relative hypoxia. Whenever you're hypoxic, right, you're going to have an increase in EPO production. So if you have an increase in EPO production, that's going to ultimately cause you to begin to pump out a ton of red blood cells. And if that happens, you're going to be polycythemic. That's one of those reasons that kids are at high risk of getting a jaundice at birth, right? Because if you think about it, you literally are having to like, oh wow, man, I have all this hemoglobin and hematocrit I need to destroy because it's excess when you're born. But also as a newborn, you have like 1% activity of like 1% activity of UDP glucuronosyl transferase, you know, compared to like a regular adult, right? So it's almost like you don't have the enzyme to help you deal with that bilirubin problem from breaking down red blood cells. But then you also have a ton of red blood cells at baseline. That's obviously going to cause a problem, right? So that's why kids are polycythemic at birth, right? And again, that's also why if a child has a cyanotic congenital heart defect, again, chronically hypoxic, that's going to cause an increase in EPO. That's going to make them polycythemic. Or a cystic fibrosis patient, their lungs don't work well, right? Or a COPD patient, if your lungs don't work well, you're going to be hypoxic. Or if you have sleep apnea, again, that's going to raise your EPO, right? And that's going to cause you to be polycythemic. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I've pretty much visited all the scenarios that I wanted to talk about. I think, again, if you understand these things, because, again, I'm sure people that are listening to this podcast understand exactly what I'm saying, where they'll give you a pediatric cardiology problem. They'll give you all these physiologic arrows and all that stuff, right? And again, it just causes people a ton of anxiety. So hopefully this podcast really clears up many of these points for you. So I wish you all the best. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one to step three, preclinical med school exams, 30 shelf exams. And then I offer a review course for the USMLE step two CK / step three exam. It's also applicable to people taking the complex level two and three exams. And then I have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify, at least the most recent 150 podcasts. It's a WordPress role. There's no really real way I have around that. So if you want all the episodes from episode one all the way to the present time, go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. If you actually subscribe to the podcast website, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And then I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post my videos. Although if you want the slides associated with those videos, you need to go under those respective episodes on my website. And also, I also work with people on ERAS applications. I know we're going through ERAS season now. So if that's something you need help with, just shoot me an email, tricky applications, wanting to match into a complex or, you know, very competitive specialty. Again, I've worked with people that are residents in many different residency programs across the country, all the way from highly ranked top of the line programs to lower ranked programs. And then, many people love the life lessons I put at the end of my podcast. So I actually started a new podcast. It's called Divine Intervention Life Lessons. The website for that is divineinterventionlifelessons.com. And also I have the podcast on Apple Podcasts, it's literally, if you check Apple Podcasts, Divine Intervention Life Lessons, I do have those. And again, it's just Bible-based teaching. It's just less than 10 minutes, right? And again, I just buttress some key life lessons I feel can really help you navigate your way through humanity as a successful person. So thank you for listening to me. I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful day. God bless you. Thank you.